Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Leadership Enigma. Well, as far as I'm aware, the only species that we employ in a business are humans. So this is a great episode to see how do we actually leverage the collective. We talk about leveraging diversity of thought, but now how do we actually leverage the collective intelligence? And that is the title of this episode, because we're going to be talking to the wonderful Jennifer Sundberg, who is the co-CEO of Board Intelligence. And I want to ask her all about collective intelligence. How do we leverage the sum of the parts? So Jennifer, no pressure, but come back to me just after this break and we'll find some answers to some of my questions. Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico and welcome to The Leadership Enigma, a world-ranked, award-winning podcast that's insatiably curious as regards what leaders do, how they do it, and importantly, why. We'll delve into the human doing, but even deeper into the human being and the power of human-centered leadership to drive sustainable change. So whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts and disruptors, as together we will discover that success leaves clues. Jennifer, it's a huge warm welcome to the Leadership Enigma. How are you?
Good, I'm delighted to be here.
What do you think of the studio? I always ask. I always like to get a bit of feedback for James and Jesse.
Very professional and conducive to a chat like this.
I think it is conducive to a chat. You are the second person who's come in today, so it's great. So I feel like we're on a roll. I've done no real introduction for you other than to say your current role at the moment and the organisation that you have. So I want to start a little bit about you, how you became the co-CEO of Board Intelligence, which I know is doing great things. Is growing at a pace, but there's always a story in relation to how a little girl grew up and became a co-CEO of an organization. How?
Sure. So, probably the beginning of this story, I could start it around 2008.
Yes.
So today we are a technology company. We support about 3,000 organizations around the world, 40,000 directors who log into our system every week.
Yep.
And but it didn't start there. Of course, it started in not just humble beginnings, but we weren't a tech company at all in the earliest days. So just before the origins of Board Intelligence, I was a strategy consultant and I had my light bulb moment. One of my clients at the time
yep.
was a chief exec of a large FTSE 250 engineering firm, very successful organization. And he invited me to join one of his board meetings as something of a fly on the wall, sit in the back of the room, observe, get to know the board directors so that when in due course we laid out the strategy, there'd be some familiarity between me and them and so on. So I had this somewhat privileged opportunity to sit and observe a FTSE 250 board meeting at a fairly early stage of my career. And this was an organization that, as I say, was riding high. They were doing very well. But they had some big strategic challenges that were coming over the brow of the hill. So the sun was shining, but you could see the storm clouds approach, which is, I think, the makings of a great board meeting, right? Some big, meaty challenges to really get
yes.
your teeth stuck into. They also had a fabulous board. So this was a board of carefully selected and relevant individuals. No trophy directors on this board. I sat there in this meeting, off they went, began. And to my surprise, over the course of the next 3 hours, they never got around to talking about any of the things that really mattered. But the reason for that was not that they had the wrong people in the room. It was the information flow. And it was the moment the penny dropped for me that no matter how good the people are in your boardroom, they're only as good as the information available to them. And information drives the conversation in the boardroom.
Right.
So in front of each board director was this giant tome, a big telephone directory of information.
All the board papers.
The board papers, the board pack. And they spent their 3 hours working their way through page by page and very studiously working through all of this. But it was backward-looking, year-to-date, financial and operational detail. And that
historic.
Was a mirror for the conversation. Exactly. It was entirely backward-looking, entirely in the weeds and mirror for the conversation that played out. And it was around the time of the financial crisis. A lot of scrutiny on boards,
yep.
a lot of attention given to what's all this question being asked, what went wrong? How did the boards of some of our largest financial institutions fly into the wall or nearly fly into the wall? And the conclusion that was reached was largely that we had the wrong people on those boards. You know, the sort of challenge laid at the feet of the likes of Heidrix and lots of great work that's been done over the decade or more since then to really transform the composition of boardrooms and make sure we have people with the skill, the will and the diversity to do a good job. But this particular board did have fantastic people on it. They had a former ambassador to China on their board. They had a champion of industry from their market on their board. They had a very
high caliber people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, information drives the conversation and it was the wrong information, which gave me this interest in, you know, could there be, you know, well, first of all, is this an anomaly? Is this the only board like it that's drowning in information and not the information that matters? Or is this a pattern? And I went on to ask more questions and discovered this was not unusual and that boards the world over struggle under the weight of information that they're presented with and struggle to find signal through the noise and struggle to have the conversations that matter most. So I decided to have a stab at fixing this. And it was around that time I met Pippa Begg. She'd had her own experiences of the boardroom, different journey. She'd worked at the Treasury and then financial services and hedge funds. And she'd seen at the sharp end what goes wrong under poor governance. So she was motivated by the question of how do you build boards that work? And together we decided to set out to see if we could solve this problem of aligning or seeking to align the information in the boardroom with the conversations that matter.
Right.
To give board directors the tools for the job. So just as you wouldn't stick a Formula One racing driver in a beaten up Volvo, you wouldn't stick Frankie Dettori on a lame horse. You shouldn't give world-class board directors subpar tools. World-class board directors require world-class tooling. And prior to the emergence of board intelligence, I'd say this was something of a gap.
Was the information and the depth and breadth of it generating the focus points as opposed to the focus points generating the information that was required? What almost cart the horse? Yeah. Who was leading who?
Habit and convention.
Okay.
So habit and convention dictated that you take a print of the financial information, the management information, the KPIs, and you print those out. And then you go, hang on, that's a good few hundred pages. That looks about enough. Yeah. And you know, I think once you look at the size of the tome that just simply grabbing the critical data points produces, your motivation to say, well, what else should go into this board pack is pretty low because it's already kind of unmanageable. So it was really a function of, you know, what was in last year's board pack around this time, what was on the agenda for the board last year around this time in the year, and you know, change the date and off you go. So it was, I think, just a habit of no one having either the time or the clear mandate to step back and say, you know, hang on, Emperor's got no clothes on. You know, we need to start from first principles. What are the critical choices this organization needs to take and this board needs to take over the coming year? What are the critical conversations we need to have in relation to that? And then what is the information that we need in service of those conversations?
When you had this experience, you said you were a young strategy consultant and you probably watched in awe and surprise. Did you give the feedback?
No.
Tell me more.
Well, I suppose at that point, I thought it was weird. I wouldn't have... Why didn't I give the feedback? I do remember chatting about it, actually, with the chief exec.
Yeah.
I remember this. I think one of the things that I quickly learned was that it's often framed that when boards are looking over here and having a conversation about the stuff that doesn't matter, it's because the management is trying to keep them off the scent and that management is trying to, you know, filibuster them or, you know, somehow distract them. And what was very clear was that that was not what was going on here.
Right.
This chief exec held his board in very high esteem. This chief exec did want his board's input to the big strategic questions. And I remember him expressing the frustration that his board meeting wasn't as useful as he would have liked it to be. It was a big time sink for him.
Mm.
And an enormous amount of time also that goes into producing this vast document every month, right? So he got no joy out of the state of play. And the board felt the same. There was shared frustration at both sides of the table, exec and non-exec, that this was not a terribly productive use of their time.
Never quite got to the
right, and it wasn't because of some malign intent. And I think that, I suppose, was probably the first myth that some of our work in the boardroom helped to expose, is that it, I mean, I'm sure there are boards where there are management teams trying to keep their boards off the scent, but certainly there are a very large number where that's not the case at all.
Right.
It's just that it is actually, you know, everyone's on a hamster wheel, right? We're all busy, and quite often you end one board cycle and it's pretty much time to start the next.
Yeah.
And there is a business to be run, you know. So working out who is going to take the time to step back and refactor something that is a pretty well-oiled machine and has been producing this stuff for decades.
Yeah.
Often disastrous doesn't quite get to the top of anyone's to-do list.
It's almost we do as we do because we do as we did. Yeah. So history repeats itself. Yeah. Isn't that sometimes called insanity, where we keep doing the same things and expecting something different to drop out of it? So you've had this epiphany moment. I want to go backwards ever so slightly just to say, what made you go into strategy consulting or be curious in the way that you were, where you saw a problem, and quite a sizable problem, at the highest levels of organisation? You thought, I need to fix that. Mm. Where's that all coming from?
So I've always been very hardworking.
Yes.
I've always been curious. I think there was that, I suppose what you have when you're young is no sense of, you feel somewhat infallible, and you feel, you have, having not yet had a chance to screw up in any major way, you feel ready for the challenge.
Yeah.
So I was not the profile of a typical, what I would have considered to be a typical entrepreneur. And even actually that word, I feel like it doesn't fit with my...
Why?
Because I always associate entrepreneurial characters with the archetype of a Richard Branson, or people who are quite anti-establishment and who... I was very hardworking at school. I was quite anxious about exams. I would study during my holidays to do the best I possibly could in my school exams and to go to the best university that I could manage. And I worked quite hard at university. And I never really railed against institutions. I didn't get into trouble much at school. And I suppose the archetype you tend to hear about is a lot more challenged by institutions. They tend to be people who never did fit the mold, and I didn't really have a problem with institutions. I just assumed I would one day leave university, join a company, climb a ladder, I guess. I think I found quite early on that one of the challenges of the real workplace was that, unlike school, where you get an exam at the end of each chapter of your school and university career that prints like where you are performing, in the world of business, you actually need to represent yourself. There isn't some independent judgment that of you. And I think I was never particularly good at representing myself in a way that you need to do to climb the ladder of a big company. So I think I saw somewhat early in my career I was going to maybe struggle with this whole political game of big company politics. I really enjoyed studying at school. I enjoyed studying at university. I enjoyed the critical thinking, the curiosity. And strategy consultancy sounded like an opportunity to continue that.
Right.
To keep asking questions, to keep learning. And that's why I chose it.
I'm listening very carefully because you and I met just a couple of days ago as well. And I remember you saying something to me, and I'm always intrigued that you know this, Jennifer. I'm always intrigued at the human being behind the human doing. And I remember you said to me, you said you've had a very normal upbringing, or you even said privileged upbringing, and you have been hardworking. And I can sense or hear in you almost in the way you describe it, almost a disconnect between you now, a co-CEO of a business that is growing quickly and doing great things, but not thinking yourself a disruptor in any way. In many ways, probably thinking of yourself as the conformist.
Well, actually, in my work, I do feel like a disruptor.
Well, this is what I mean, because you haven't got a business this size doing this kind of work without something going on.
No, we're all about trying to challenge the status quo.
Yeah.
And trying to, you know, do things differently and better.
Yes.
And I suppose it's just that I was quite, I suppose, you know, I wasn't a rebel as a kid. I actually found myself in the workplace suddenly feeling like a rebel.
Okay.
And it did feel peculiar to suddenly feel like a disruptor, like a challenger. That wasn't the persona I'd had as a kid.
Yeah.
But I guess it is where I've ended up, and it's a lot of fun. I suppose that there is a sort of the archetype is often people who you know they fail at school, but they've got that entrepreneurial spark. I guess for me, I was always engaged by ideas and by thinking. And it wasn't, I wouldn't say I was particularly driven by any particular commercial outcome. It was, for me, it was very much, it's been about the journey. It's about the nature of the work that we do, the nature of the impact that we have that's motivated me.
And maybe the entire success of the business, the book, is all around critical thinking. And maybe that was your disruptive and that was the entrepreneur in you. It was almost, how do you internalize and process and think and consider, as opposed to that sometimes slightly disruptive, flamboyant entrepreneur that we might see, I think only because it sells headlines very well. But let's be honest, the CEOs of businesses are made up of all types.
But I think you need to have a bit of a fight in you, right, to keep battling through the dark days. And I think I had a bit of that fight, probably a function of being, you know, emerging into... So I had a pretty privileged upbringing, no question. But I had that fight of wanting to show that, anything a man can do, a woman can do it too.
Okay.
And I think that was quite motivating. So when I graduated around 2000 and 2001, there were 5% of the board seats across the FTSE 100 were held by women.
Right.
So across 1,000 or so board positions, 50 were held by women. Half the FTSE 100 were male only. And I think I found that extremely motivating, thinking, let's go fix that. I went to a all-girls school and very strong emphasis on the importance of getting out into the world and you know, socking it to the men, right, and showing the world what we could do. And I think that, I think that put a bit of a fire in me.
Okay.
So, and as it happens, although the data might sound bad, you know, I could probably paint a picture of sort of woe is me, you know, this highly male dominated working environment, but truthfully the sounding gun had also been fired when I stepped into the workplace, the sounding gun to really change that and to promote and empower women. So as you know, at Hydrex, and as I know well, over the last 20 years we've gone from 5% of board seats being held by women to now 40%. You know, we've gone from half the FTSE 100 boards being male only to not a single male only board. I mean, it would just be utterly weird in this day and age to find a FTSE 100 board that was all men. It just wouldn't happen. And I think, you know, I probably did ride something of a wave over this last, you know, certainly the first 10 years of my career, where there was, you know, I was hammering on a door that had just been unlocked. And I actually, over particularly the first 10 years, building board intelligence, well, and continued, but we had such a lot of support from men who were keen to promote, I suppose, the cause that we were somewhat connected with, and benefited hugely from that. So I think it was very fortunate timing, actually, kicking off my career when I did. As I say, the data could make it look very challenging, but actually it was at the start of a sea change.
Okay.
Still work to be done, right? Because
there's a lot of change in our lifetimes, if you think about it, which is wonderful. But there's still more work to do.
I mean,
and to continually do as well.
Exactly. And they, like, fewer than 10 chief execs in the FTSE 100 are women, right? And racial diversity has got a long way to go. Social mobility, there's still, you know, huge amount to be done. But I think it's bred in me this sense of optimism.
Yes.
Having seen played out in a fairly short period of time the extent of the change that is possible.
Right. Okay. Thank you. I mean, I appreciate it. I love to kind of dig into who you are, and then we can come back to what you do. So let me just summarize it a little bit. So you had that moment, or a little bit of an epiphany, as we call it. You had that where you actually saw that there was too much data. It was all retrospective, historical data, therefore in the weeds, not future focused, dealing with the nitty gritty issues that boards need to grapple with, and certainly probably didn't have any data to assist them on that front either. You then get in touch with Pippa. She's a like-minded individual. You decided to create Board Intelligence. What was Board Intelligence when it first started?
Sure. So to begin with, we were a consulting firm,
yep,
but specialising in the problem of fixing the problem of the board information. And our first few clients, very first client was EasyJet.
Yep.
And the success of that took us into the boards of the other independent directors on the board of EasyJet.
Right.
I mean, one of the beauties of our work from the point of view of a company that in its earliest days has no money, you have this fantastic snowball effect of the multi-boarded nature of your clients. So do a good job for one board and suddenly that opens the door to another 10.
Yeah, of course.
And so we had that sort of snowball effect early doors. It never occurred to us that there could be a technology play in what we were doing. We started with the assumption that every client would require a completely different solution. And we'd be working with EasyJet one day, a FTSE 100 mining company the next, a hospital trust the next. And how could you possibly productize the solution? But I suppose a couple of things that came up that we hadn't expected. One was a client, actually EasyJet again, asking if we would, having fixed the contents of their board deck with a whole new set of templates, a whole new way of thinking about the information they submit to the board, they asked us if we'd project manage it for them. And that took us into the world of essentially printing, binding and couriering board documents to non-exec directors on a Friday night, trying to find their home address, trying to work out which of their various homes they were in this weekend and trying to get the documents to them on time because you can't email a board deck to a non-exec's Gmail address. And that was obviously not a lot of fun. And we realized that we had this team of top university educated grads who joined because they wanted to change the conversation in boardrooms around the world and stood at the printer and the binding machine at 11 o'clock at night on a Friday. And so we built a bit of tech to help us manage that process ourselves.
Who was the techie, you or Pippa or another?
So neither of us.
Right, okay.
And a colleague of ours, Johnny Knight, well, he wasn't either, but he was happy to have a go at working with the two of us to try to commission some engineers to build us a product. And then we hired some engineers, software engineers, and we built a team. And we've learned a lot the hard way over the years about how to build and run engineering teams.
Yes.
And but initially, we built a product for ourselves to make the administration of the process around putting a board deck together to make that easy. And then eventually, our client said, EasyJet specifically, well, hang on, you don't need us anymore to do this. Just license the tech from us. And they did. And so we started with our first tech product was a product to help distribute board papers,
right,
board portal.
The portal.
And then the next thing that happened on the journey was we realized after we'd done probably 40 or 50 of these consulting projects working with boards, we realized that we had actually built up a bank of know-how about how to fix the problem of the contents of your board deck. We would ask every board we worked with, tell us what the questions are that are firing off in your mind when you sit down to read your board deck. You pick up a chief exec report, what are the questions you want the answers to? Or you pick up a proposal to the board asking for a bunch of money off the board. Again, what are the questions firing off in your mind? And we found that across these diverse sectors and companies of all different shapes and sizes, the questions were the same questions that they wanted insight into and typically weren't getting.
Yep.
So for instance, chief exec report, the number one question on any board director's mind is what is keeping the chief exec up at night? They also want to know, what's your level of confidence in delivering the goals for the year and what do we need to stop doing, start doing and do differently? All sorts of questions that sound like common sense, right? But 9 in 10 chief exec reports didn't answer either of those questions. And we built up what we called the question bank, this tremendous bank of questions. And we found ourselves able to use these questions across different businesses to pretty great effect. And then we've learned how to, using technology, now package up these questions into a software platform that management can use to help them craft their briefing paper for the board. So we have essentially it's a thinking and writing platform called Lucia that management teams use to help them think through what is the conversation I'm trying to enable in my boardroom? What are the critical questions on the mind of the board? How do I get to the nub of the answers using AI to help challenge or at least reflect back whether you as a manager have really truly answered that question, answered it well, and to help you communicate that answer more clearly.
And when we were chatting, you called it's a question-driven insight.
So our methodology is the question-driven insight principle.
Yes. Tell us, what do you mean by that?
So questions. There's a great quote from Einstein that goes something like this. If I had an hour to solve a problem and my life depended on it, I would spend the first 55 minutes working out the proper question to answer. Because once I've worked out the question that needs answering, I can answer it in 5 minutes. Questions are the catalyst to critical thinking, the catalyst to curiosity. And I suppose what we're doing with our work is helping to build a culture within management of asking and answering the difficult questions. And we see huge value in questioning. Of course, we're all born questioners. You know, you look at any toddler and we know that they ask questions all day.
Even the simple one, why?
Why? Exactly. Stephen Hawking said, I'm just like a three-year-old that just never grew up. I just ask a lot of how and why questions.
Yeah.
Occasionally I find an answer. But I suppose unlike Stephen Hawking, most of us have that beaten out of us. You know, our school careers, our formal education system.
Yeah.
It's often about learning the answers to the questions that you expect to be asked. And it's not just any answer, but very specifically the answer that the examiner will have in the back of the examiner's booklet. And the emphasis is not on can you identify the critical question? The emphasis is on do you know the pre-canned answer? And a lot of what we're doing with our work is helping to recultivate or helping management to get that questioning mojo back, putting more time and attention into thinking hard about the critical questions and thinking deeply about high quality answers to those questions.
And if anyone's thinking, well, you know, why does this matter? It's obvious from how you're describing it, but I remember making some notes, excuse my voice, I remember making some notes when we were together. It's about focusing people on the conversations that matter, avoid wasted time and effort. That would be nice, wouldn't it? And do less harm. This was an interesting one. You talked about do less harm with the right data and information. Just explain that one a little bit, because I love that, but I want you to explain it.
So I could be a bit long-winded, so just shut me up if I go on too long. Yeah. Back to when we started the business around 2008.
Yeah.
All this attention on board directors, and it wasn't favourable, right? They were largely, I think somebody called them the boards of our largest companies are the retirement homes for the great and the good. It was a pretty unflattering portrait that was painted of board directors.
Yeah.
And I think I had the impression that board directors were somewhere between lazy, a bit stupid, self-interested, self-serving.
Yep.
And then through our work, we got to meet a lot of board directors, and nothing could have been further.
A lot of myth-busting happened.
Experience. Yeah. What we met were people who were passionate about the businesses they were on, hard-working, and far more socially minded than we would ever have believed.
Right.
And what we realised was that, I suppose, what I've come to see generally about the world, my view on the world is, there's a bell curve, there's a distribution curve in any community, and there are the really bad people over at one side, and I don't know how you deal with that. I have no clue what the cure is for truly bad people. There's then the people who are, your Mother Teresa's, and they'll always do the right thing. And then there's the great mass in the middle who are broadly good, but who, depending on the conditions and the environment, you'll get the best out of them or you won't. And I think what we saw is that most board directors were broadly decent human beings, and present them with good information about the implications of the decisions they're going to take, and they'll do the right thing.
Right.
They don't wish to do harm to society. They would like to leave a positive legacy. They would like their children and grandchildren to speak kindly of them and the impact of their life's work. And that most of the time when harm is done, it's out of ignorance and certainly not intent. And I think seeing this, seeing good people in large company boardrooms preside over sometimes bad decisions, bad not just for the company, but bad for the stakeholder impact.
Yeah.
And then knowing that those people were actually pretty decent, it became clear to us that they were badly informed. They were not being furnished with good visibility and good understanding of the impact of the decisions they're taking. So part of what we're doing is helping good people take good decisions by making sure they can see the second, third order consequences of the decisions they're about to take.
And the reality is they want to solve the big, audacious, knotty right. problems. That is yeah. the fun stuff, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. That's why you sign up to be on a board.
You don't want to look historically, maybe some things you can't change history,
right?
But yeah. you can help an organization and the people within that organization and the communities within which they serve. You can help them successfully navigate both opportunity and challenge. Is that a fair summary?
Completely, completely.
I want to ask you what tell me where board intelligence is now, and what is the hope, what is the aspiration? Because I know you're a classic entrepreneur in that you paid yourself nothing, you self-financed, you did all those things that we historically hear entrepreneurs do, you probably had a maniacal focus with it, didn't sleep. We're now in a different place. What's the hope for board intelligence going forward?
So we are still a very UK-based business. About 80% of our business is still done from the UK. The next step for us is international growth. We want to do what we do in every boardroom in the world, not just in the UK.
Right.
We also want to do more, not just to support the way decisions are taken in the boardroom, but the way decisions are taken at every level of the organization. So there's a reason our book is titled Collective Intelligence.
We're going to come onto that as well,
right? And not board intelligence, exactly. And that stems from the realization that actually even the boards we work with that are the most high performing,
yep.
even when we really get a board humming, it's not enough. And in this day and age where it's the fast that eat the slow, not the big that eat the small, you've got to be able to move at pace. And if all of the really big decisions in your organization have to slowly work their way up to the very top of the organization to be ratified,
yes.
you just won't be able to move fast.
That's the turning circle of an ocean liner, isn't
exactly.
it?
So you've got to be able to trust that decisions will be taken well throughout the organization, but you don't get that trust just on hope and a prayer.
Yeah.
You've got to make sure you've got the right skills, capabilities, and processes to build the capability to then discharge greater authority well.
Yes.
And so what we're doing increasingly is taking what we've learned from the boardroom about how to think well, take good decisions at pace. And we're now cascading that through our clients' organizations, which is about building three critical capabilities.
We're going to come on to that, aren't we? And I love the quote, the testimonial that's on the front from Daniel Pink, who many will know as a New York Times bestselling author. An essential guide to help leaders tap their organization's full potential. That's what this is about, isn't it? This is about tapping into the potential of every single person, leveraging the complete collective of an organization, not just the most senior or the longest in tenure. That's what this is about, isn't it?
Exactly. Which is about cutting out waste, right? What a waste to hire all these people and then not tap into their grey matter.
Let's talk about the three capabilities, because I think this will help any leader of any size organization. And this really resonates with me because, as you know, my background as a trial lawyer, we talked about the habit of questioning and how one might critical think. And those were perhaps partly the bedrock of being mildly competent before a judge and a jury. So help us understand, what are the three capabilities that any leader should be thinking about for their organization in its entirety? So let's start with the first one.
So yeah, so critical thinking, clear communication, and focus. Those are the three.
Let's start with the first one.
So one thing I'd say first about all three is simply that it's only mildly useful to hear me say that these three things are important. We kind of all know that. What I hope is more useful is what we share in the book about how you build habits around each of these three.
Yes.
Good habits, habits at work. Because, you know, we all know that we should think, you know, sharper and more clearly, and we should communicate that thinking better, because great thinking that's not well communicated will wither on the vine. And we also can sense from first principles, if you get your whole organization thinking well, communicating well, without focus, you're just going to pull in opposite directions and it'd be utter chaos, right? So focus is also vital to align all of that thinking power
okay.
to some common end. So, but as I say, that's only mildly useful.
But if you get this right, I want you to explain that. But when a leader or an organization gets this right, then you can, with confidence, delegate, empower, and have people who are closest to the problems solve them.
Exactly. I mean, John Timpson of the shoe repair fame, you know, he's put it very well. He refers to this as upside down governance.
Right.
And he sees it as the job of every level of management to empower and upskill and enable the level below, on the grounds that it's people closest to the front line who have access to the most timely data and can, you know, if they can use that data and respond well by taking good decisions in real time.
Yes. Real okay.
In fact, John Timpson, we pitched to him once, and we learned this the hard way. We're pitching to him a presentation in our boardroom, a presentation that had gotten us into the banks of HSBC, Citibank, NatGrid, all sorts. We're pretty confident about this presentation deck. And then 5 slides in, he held his hand up like he was trying to stop the oncoming traffic, and he couldn't take it anymore. And he said, "Stop." He said, "I don't need a better boardroom. The important decisions in my business are not made in my boardroom." Which for me and Pippa at the time was, you know, a bit of a stomach blow. And then he shared with us his views on upside down governance, which took us a few years to really appreciate what he was saying. So I'd say that penny dropped very slowly for us, but it did. And now that for us is a real focus.
Did you change anything as a result of that kind of aha moment or that wonderful feedback?
I think we changed to not then and there, but we probably should have done it. Now we focus, so we're still known in the boardroom, we still work with boards around the world, but we spend a lot more time and we get a lot more excited about the nature of the impact we can have through our clients' organisations, the cultural transformation.
The collective.
Engender, that's right. And I think also seeing, you know, just like the next person, I enjoy reading about these larger-than-life CEO characters, these Silicon Valley leaders, your Musks, your Bezos, your, you know, Jobs, etc. And then I think learning a bit more about them over the years and learning that when you peel the onion, when you look below the surface at organizations that would appear to be built by individuals who are individually brilliant, and they are. But what surprised me is below the surface, there's a lot more going on than just their brilliance. And, you know, Steve Jobs didn't come up with the idea of the iPhone. He had to be persuaded into the mobile market by colleagues of his who thought this was a good idea. Jeff Bezos didn't come up with the idea of Amazon Prime. It was an engineer in his business. Warren Buffett's best ever bet at Berkshire Hathaway was the decision to back Apple. But that was not a decision he took. That was a decision one of his lieutenants took.
Right.
He was fiercely against it, but he gave them the rope and they took that call and it worked. And I was chatting to a woman called Anne Hyatt, who was chief of staff to Eric Schmidt and Jeff Bezos. And she said, you know, these larger than life CEOs, their confidence is incomparable. But they've also thought hard about how to help others to think well. And undoubtedly, that is why they've been as successful as they are. So, you know, the businesses that are enduringly successful, the ones that keep winning decade after decade, are about a lot more than just the superstar at the top.
Right.
Superstar that they are. It's about a lot more than just that. And no one person, to your point earlier, no one person can be everywhere all at once, solving every problem. And too much power concentrated in any one individual makes you stupid, as history has shown us time and time again, from, you know, Icarus to you name your chief exec scandal of the week, right? So building organizations capable of delegating decision-making authority well, taking those decisions well, is important. But back to the how. Sorry,
yeah.
Your question,
again, this is fascinating because, you know, I can tell you've been writing a book because there's a storytelling element, isn't there, coming out, which is I think, always a lovely way to describe, explain concepts. Let's go back to the how. So in relation to the three capabilities, the critical thinking, communicating better, and focus.
Yeah.
So best advice for anyone listening or watching this to at least get started on it.
Sure. So so critical thinking, as I mentioned earlier, so it's about building the habit of questioning, asking more and better questions. You know, you've got to make it easy to do well and hard to avoid. So we use and recommend others use the medium of the meeting, whether it's a board meeting, whether it's a quarterly business review, whether it's a monthly management update,
right.
Those formal set pieces throughout the year, the annual budgeting and planning process, all of those formal set pieces, they're already calendarized in people's diaries. It's not about finding time and magically discovering time you didn't previously have. Hijacking those existing rituals or existing routines and turning them into rituals by turning them into the place where you start by working out what are the critical questions,
right.
And building a culture around that, about saying, you know, before we begin this meeting, what are the questions we're here to answer? Before I sit down to write my quarterly business review, performance report, my paper for the board, whatever it might be, step one, what are the critical questions that I need to provide insight in answer to?
It's not rocket science, is it? But it's funny how it not yeah. happening or hasn't been happening.
Exactly. So you can use that activity that already exists
yep.
to turn it into the place that builds this questioning muscle. And then the other thing we've learned, you know, the best questions are the simplest, right? So I think, you know, you start on this and you start on this journey, you can spend a lot of time thinking, what are the clever questions? What's the clever question I need to identify? And what we've learned and we share in the book is that actually that is a distraction.
Right.
The most powerful questions are the simplest. It's the why, the so what, the now what, and building confidence.
Almost thinking the inner child
exactly,
in us.
Exactly. The next thing, as I mentioned, is about communication.
Yep.
No good doing all this great thinking if you can't inspire others to action around it. Business is a team sport. Got to be able to communicate it well to invite both challenge, but also to motivate others, you know, incite a response. And the problem with that is most of us in business are pretty terrible communicators. And I think communication is referred to as the silent killer of large organizations.
Right.
And I mean, we know this well at Board Intelligence because we see these board decks, right? And it's a skill, and it's not one that we seem to be good at in business, you know, clear communication, written communication. So, you know, some of our clients before working with us might use their entire board meeting for people to come and present PowerPoint decks, which completely wastes the opportunity for meaningful discussion in a boardroom. Also means you're very much at the mercy of who's the most charismatic presenter rather than who's got the best quality thinking to share. So one of the things we do is build the skill of narrative reporting in an organization, but doing it concisely, doing it
right.
clearly. And that's mainly about unlearning what we learn at school and university, which tends to make us very bad at written communication. So what we share in the book is we put it down to five tenets of communication that we rip up and consign to the bin and replace with five new ways of thinking about
okay.
communication in business. So I'll give you one example.
Yes.
For the rest, you have to the book. So tend to, many of us think that a formal situation demands formal tone of voice, formal language.
Yes.
And you know, if I'm writing for my board or if I'm writing for my boss, I need to adopt a certain formality. And that tends to lead us to use long words, long sentences, lots of filler phrases. And what we help people to see is that actually you should write like a human, no matter what you're writing about. So, you know, short words actually make us sound smarter. And you know, there is no substitute for clarity. If you can't communicate clearly, then you're not likely to be understood. You're not likely to get support.
This is taking me back to my trial law days.
But I think, you know, so helping people to write more like they speak and helping people to understand that actually that will come across better. It'll also display more accountability. So quite often when you write in a more formal tone of voice, as well as long words and long sentences, people tend to write in a more impersonal style.
Right.
You know, it was reported that, or it is necessary to, or sales results were missed. You know, third person passive voice. And actually that puts distance between you and your message.
Right.
Own the message, you know, I think blah, 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 you know, we did X, Y, Z, you know, we missed our sales results if you missed them. Own it, because owning it will show accountability, it'll show leadership, and that's what your reader is looking for.
Right.
So we help to change some of these sorts of habits. I'd say there are five of them stated in there.
Okay.
Go and have a read. And then finally, focus, because as we said, you know, you can't empower people to take decisions if they're not all pointing at the same North Star and pulling that energy in the same direction. And focus is a superpower. The Romans were apparently weaker, shorter, poorer, and less intellectually astute than all of their neighbours.
Right.
But they conquered the lot of them. They conquered the lot of them because they were organised. There's a Roman military historian called Vegetius who writes about this, and the power of alignment, the power of focus, is tremendous. And so then the question is, how do you focus and align? You know, you may have tens of thousands of people in your organisation scattered around the world. If you're going to entrust and empower them all to take decisions, how do you make sure that energy is focused? And that's where we recommend that you identify critical questions for your organisation that you will push down. So whilst a lot of the book and a lot of our thesis is about empowerment and enablement, channel that by setting questions that you want everybody to engage with. And we got lots of examples about this, about clients of ours initiating massive transformations of their organisation from an organisation that pointed that way to suddenly pointing that way. How do you do that, right? How do you get everybody to not, because focus is about often changing focus, easier said than done. How do you initiate a change of focus whilst also stimulating people to think and not trying to clip their wings, you're just trying to get them to fly in a certain direction? And questions can be powerful for that. So what we do is we'd say, you know, every management report from now on will consider the following three questions. You can add other questions of your own, but these are three critical questions that this organization at this point in time recognizes are the questions that we need every manager to have in their mind.
So it aligns people on those elements.
And there's a saying that, you know, he or she who controls the questions controls the conversation.
Right.
You can't be in every meeting room as a chief exec or as a leadership team. You can't be in every meeting room across your organization all of the time focusing that thinking power. But you can set the questions. You can set some of the questions. And that can be a pretty powerful aligning.
Okay. So those three capabilities are more and better critical thinking, communicating better, and obviously focus, focus, focus. All of which can be revealed in your book. When's it out?
It came out in November. It was the FT Book of the Month. And it is available on Amazon and other good bookshops.
Well, we share the same publisher.
We do.
Which is always nice, which is, I think, how we were introduced, which is great. How can people get in touch with you or Board Intelligence and continue the conversation or get you involved in their conversation? How do we do that?
Thank you. So I'm on LinkedIn, Jennifer Sundberg, and our website. And reach out anytime and I'd be delighted to have a chat.
Fine. And I'll put all those details in the show notes as well so people can just see that, click on that and get straight through to you. Listen, Jennifer, thank you so much. I know we've just scraped the surface, but I hope there's been some rich learning in here. Well, I don't hope. I know there has been, especially in relation to the stories and examples you've given. So thank you so much for taking the time to come in. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Pleasure. Join us again next week for more curiosity and insight with the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with me on LinkedIn or visit us at www.leadersenigma.com. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms and on our dedicated YouTube channel. Thanks again for joining the community.